Okay, so welcome and thank you for coming out in the cold and the ice. So this is a series of talks, as I mentioned last week, and I hope to make each one sort of self-contained and of interest in itself. But they do all form part of a larger series of talks. So I ask you to please sort of bear that in mind. Last week was the first talk in this series, and what I did then was explored the context of our lives. I started by mentioning the three questions: who am I, what am I doing, and where am I going? And I looked at us within the whole cosmic context. I tried to put our own individual lives here and now into a cosmic context. Now this week we're going to come back more to the microcosm, just to the universe that is ourselves. We do place ourselves actually at the centre of the universe, kind of revolves around us. So this is what I want to explore this week. So what I want to explore this week is me and my world, not me personally, but you know, you and your world, me and my world, us and our world. So last week we learned that all things arise in dependence upon condition. Everything that exists has arisen from the Big Bang. That we don't know about quite where that came from, but ever since then, anyway, all things have arisen in dependence upon conditions. Nothing has existed forever. Everything has come into being as a result of something before it. And last week we saw that even space, and strange to say, time, also are conditioned. They too have come into existence in dependence upon something that went before them. So this whole idea of evolution captures, if you like, the essence of reality. This is one thing that we can actually say is real, that things arise in dependence upon conditions. We, you and I, have come into being as a result of the evolution of the cosmos. We are the cutting edge of that 13.7 billion years of evolution. We've inherited the products of this evolution. We've inherited space and time. We've inherited our atoms and molecules that are within us. We've inherited our life, the fact that we're living creatures. And we've inherited a simple consciousness, the amazing miracle of a consciousness of the world around us. So this inheritance is our nature. It's what we're born with. We're born in space and time with certain chemicals, atoms, molecules that are so organized that they produce a living being. That living being has got a consciousness of its environment, an awareness of its environment. This is what we come into this world with. And out of this nature, this inherited nature, we've developed a sophisticated self-consciousness. We each have an awareness of me and my world, me and the world. This is sort of fundamental to our experience, me and the world, me and the world. We can't, it's very difficult to imagine a consciousness that doesn't have a me in the world. Now this world that we live in, and this me that we are, is a result also of an evolutionary process. It's the evolution of creative activity from past generations. We've inherited this as well. We've inherited something of our self-consciousness because of the creative activity of previous living beings, previous human beings. right from the invention of the word, we could perhaps identify the word, the use of a word, as the beginning of human consciousness. I'm not sure if this is in any way accurate, but we could certainly look at it in this way. From the beginning of the word to the development of the arts and the sciences, even to the invention of the World Wide Web, all of these things, we inherit them and we experience our world, me and our world, as a result of this inherited culture which we learn. But we also have report, if not direct experience, from mystics, poets, philosophers and the great religious of something beyond this experiential world, beyond this world that we normally experience on an everyday level. And that is, in a way, the core of what I would call genuine religious activity, the pursuit of this higher world, whatever it may be. We'll be coming on to that, hopefully, in later talks. Sangharakshita has coined the terms lower and higher evolutions to refer to the lower evolution, referring to what we've inherited, our physical form and our simple consciousness, and the beginnings of our self-consciousness. The higher evolution is what goes on from here forwards, what goes on from here for each of us forwards. And it's an evolution in the individual. The evolution, the individual continues that evolutionary process onwards, both in terms of refining, purifying, deepening our understanding of ourselves and the world in which we live, but also beyond that into something which, for the sake of these talks, I'm going to try and use the term transcendental consciousness. There are problems with that term, but let's kind of hang loose with it. And transcendental consciousness refers to this higher dimension that these mystics and poets and others have had some kind of experience of, some kind of touch with. So, the rest of the series, from now onwards, is going to be concerned with the higher evolution, this higher evolution of the individual, into an even more, a greater purified state of consciousness. I'll define this term purified a little later on, into a, let's say, more refined state of self-consciousness, and beyond that, again for the sake of terminology, into transcendental consciousness. Now, the higher individual, higher evolution of the individual is what Buddhism is all about. That is what Buddhism is. Traditional Buddhism, I'm going to talk a little bit now about traditional Buddhism's view of what we've been talking about. Traditional Buddhism takes on a kind of pre-Buddhist cosmic view, sometimes referred to as a Hindu cosmic view, but it's Vedic, it's earlier than that. So it's the view that the universe expands and contracts. Yeah? It's going through these continual cycles of expansion and contraction. Expansion and contraction. Fits in quite well, actually, with modern scientific understanding. The modern scientific understanding is just the expansion of this bit. We don't know much more than that. But the Hindu myth, the Hindu image, was one of expansion and contraction. And the Buddha accepted that. So what we could say is that this idea of a universe that sort of is continually in flux, expanding and contracting, must have fitted in with his vision of the nature of reality, with his vision of this higher consciousness. It must have been a view that supported that understanding. So I think we can, in a way, rest quite safely and say that the modern scientific view of the expansion of the universe fits in very well with Buddhist ideas. It's not a contradiction. The Buddha identified, again, strictly it wasn't the Buddha, it came a little bit later, but the Buddhist tradition, let's say, identifies five orders of conditionality. Five orders of evolution. Buddhism quite often tries not to talk about things so much. So it's not talking about the universe and the parts of it as a thing. It's talking about them as processes. So these five orders of conditionality really represent five processes that the early Buddhist thinkers saw the universes as consisting of. So the first of these is called these processes, by the way, are called the niyamas. The first of these is called the uttu niyama, which means more or less, not exactly by any means, but more or less the development of the physical universe, the physical material universe. So that corresponds, in a way, the uttu niyama corresponds to the whole process of evolution from the Big Bang right up to the production of atoms and molecules and so on, and onwards. So it recognises that that process of material evolution is ongoing, it's continuing. Out of this arises the bija niyama, the order of conditionality that's to do with living things, living entities. So first of all, complex molecules that split, reproduce themselves, single cell organisms and so on. So on top of this level of conditionality in the material world, there's a level of conditionality within the living world. There's this whole process, this whole kind of soup, if you like, of evolution of life, which is continuing on top of that. On top of that, there's what's called the mano-niyama. And the mano-niyama is what I've been calling simple consciousness. Arising out of these living beings is this idea of simple consciousness. Arising out of the simple consciousness that's developed is the karma-niyama, which is the consciousness of, it's the processes that give rise to a consciousness of a self, of me living in a world. And beyond that, it recognises what it calls the dharma-niyama, which is the higher level, the transcendent order of evolution. So I find it very interesting to see that, early Buddhist thinkers, philosophers, developed, not scientifically, but developed through sort of, reflecting on the nature of things and looking around them, experiencing things. They developed this fivefold level of conditionality. So we are concerned not with the uttu niyama, the bija niyama, or the mano niyama, not with material things, not with just the evolution of living things, nor with the evolution of simple consciousness. We're going to be concerned from now on with the karma niyama and the dharma niyama. The karma niyama is that order of conditionality that gives rise, that those processes that give rise to the sense of me living in a world. Yeah? Me living in the world arises out of various conditions, which are, we refer to as the karma niyama. And then beyond that, there's the dharma niyama, this higher order of conditionality and consciousness, which we will be touching on later on. Well, we touch on it every now and again, actually, as you do, the transcendental. But we'll be coming to it more later on. So, today, we're going to look at me and my world. We're going to look at the processes, or at least some elements of the processes of the karma niyama. Just a little bit about analysis. I'm going to be doing quite a lot of analysis over the course of the next few talks. Now, I know analysis is not everybody's cup of tea, but it quite often helps to take a situation, to take an experience, and break it down into its elements. And then you can start looking at those elements and you can see something of the processes that go on, the relationships between the elements. So this is really what we're going to be doing today with the individual and for the next few talks with the mind itself. I think that Buddhist psychology, Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist psychology really, is really, it's a science of observation. Of observation and analysis. I like to think it's a little bit like 19th century botanists or geologists. You know, they just went around and they looked at things and they made lists of all the different sorts of things that they found. And so it was observation, labelling, identifying, creating the, you know, the order of living beings, creating the order of fossils in geological levels, creating orders of plants and so on. Just by looking at things and identifying and noticing the differences of the different sorts of entities. What's useful about this is once you recognise, once you've analysed something and recognised it, you start to see it more. And if you start to see it more, then you can see how it relates to other things. So it's a very, very useful way of getting moving into the forest of the mind, as it were, by learning to know some of the names of the trees and the plants in that forest. There's a friend of mine, Ratna Prabha, who gave a talk here fairly recently, I think. We used to live together at Padmaloka. And going for a walk in the country with Ratna Prabha was a real eye-opener, because he really knows his stuff. He knows his biology, he knows his flora, he knows his fauna. And you're walking along and you say, oh, such and such a thing. And, I mean, to me it was just like some green leafy stuff that was there. But once you've had it pointed out, you start to see it everywhere. You start to notice it. So gradually you start, a walk in the country becomes much, much more fascinating because you start to see all of the different things that are growing around. And this is what we're going to do, because we're going to be making an exploration into our own minds. And what we need to do that is just the recognition of a few of the major flora and fauna of our own minds, a few of the recognisable elements of our own minds. So today we're going to start with the crudest analysis, the very basic analysis of me. And then after that, I'm going to look at a very crude and basic analysis of the world. So for the rest of today, we're going to spend a bit of time on looking at ourselves, me, and then a little bit of time looking at the world. And I've done a little drawing. I'm afraid I'm not very artistic. This is a bit of a mess. Each of these red circles is around a word, which is an approximate translation, at least a translation I'm going to use, for the five skandhas. The five skandhas, the five heaps, these are the five heaps that the Buddha, in his own teaching, analysed the self into. He said it consists of these five things. Now, these are worthy of a lot of reflection to try and sort of really come to understand what they refer to. What I hope to do today is to give a kind of a simplified but not, I hope, inaccurate introduction to what each of these skandhas are. So if we analyse ourselves, we take ourselves, we look at ourselves, we say, well, what's the first thing we see? The first thing I think we would see is probably a body, a form. I look out and I can see my hand. This is my hand. It's not anybody else's. I can see the rest of my body. So form really means what we perceive. It also involves contact with the world itself. So it's at the moment the form of my experience is the bare awareness of the presence of everybody in this room and so on. So it's everything that everything that I have contact with in the outside world, my own body or the sense input that I'm receiving. So we could say that this word form consists of all of the sense input that we have, including the sensations of our own body. So let's just reflect on that a little bit. It's everything that we are aware of through our senses. So it's because we talk about, you know, what, you know, my sight, don't we? What I see, what I smell, what I, though it's very much me that's sort of smelling, touching those things. So this form represents all of that, that sense input, just the raw sense input. Now the response to that is we have a feeling towards it. So we go up, we have some sort of feeling about our experience, our contact with the world. And basically these feelings form into just three categories. It's either pleasurable, it's painful, or it's neutral. And it could be said that neutrality really is just a very, very low intensity of pleasure or pain. So we're really concerned primarily with pleasure and pain. So it's very useful to actually just observe one's vedana, feeling. This is the original word is vedana. So to know whether this experience is pleasurable or painful or what. So you might be saying, well, okay, it's my experience here is heat, you know, it's warm. Now, is that pleasurable or painful? Well, not too comfortable, so it's a little bit unpleasurable, but you might be listening to this talk and saying, well, I can hear this person's voice. You know, is that person's voice, is it pleasurable or is it a bit unpleasant in some way? Yeah. We've always got some kind of feeling tone, some liking or disliking, some experience of pleasure or pain associated with our experience. And it's a very good exercise to really try and honestly look at what our feeling is, to know what our feeling is. The reason why it's important to know what our feeling is because that determines how we respond to things. So we're going to cross over to emotions. In dependence upon how we feel about something, we will have an emotional reaction. Very crudely speaking, if something is unpleasant, we want to push it away. If something is pleasant, we want to maintain it, to keep it. So just do this one day walking down the street. Walk down the street, be aware of what your sense experience is. Be aware of whether it's pleasurable or painful, and be aware of your emotional reaction to it. Emotional reactions always arise in dependence upon feelings. They come from our feelings of liking or disliking. Now these emotions, as I said, very, very crudely, they can be their desire or hatred, craving or hatred. We're either happy to hold on to them or we want to get rid of them. Now we'll see over the course of the next several weeks that there's a vast variety, there's a great richness in these emotional states. And there's complexities where you get combinations of emotional states. So this emotions really is the key working area, because in dependence upon the feelings we have, these emotions arise. And in dependence upon those emotions, we act. We start to do things. And when we do things, we start to create our world. Now, there's something else that happens, which I put up there as perception, samnya, which helps in this process. Perception is really thought. It can be quite simple labelling. In the morning, you get up and there's this wonderful smell, very pleasurable, and you label it coffee. You know, the world comes into being. You know, existence is good. There is a universe with something in it called coffee. So just the simple labelling of that thing. And, you know, everything's put in order. Everything's right again. It's all sort of come together. So it can be quite simple labelling. Or it can be very complex, complex labelling. I think actually the simplest label is mama. Yeah, I don't know if there's any linguists here, and I might well be wrong, But it seems to me that the first thing that most of us say is mama. Now, what does mama mean? I mean, later on we're told it means mother, but I think it's not that. Mama means warmth, comfort, food, affection. It's all, it means these things, yeah? It's some sort of, you know, mama. It's the same in all languages, I believe. So it's something universal about that sound, which is the recognition, the identification of something which is pleasurable, which we want to move towards. A child loves mama, you know, is always drawn towards mama because that word represents the whole experience of that, you know, almost sort of perfect state. But we make it much, it becomes complex. Our explanations of our experiences become very complex. Sometimes the words are enough to do, to identify things. I heard on, I think it was Woman's Hour actually, the other day, that there's a lot of words in different languages that are not represented in English. And various examples were given from Chinese, Japanese, Russian, that represent sort of emotional states that we don't normally identify. And so when we have those emotional states, we don't really kind of know them. We don't know what they are. Whereas people in these other languages know exactly what they are. But they can also be stories. You know, he did this to me, and then he did that, and then he did that, and then he did that. And, you know, he did all this to me. Whereas what we're really doing is rationalising the painful experience that we had, and then the emotional response to want to kind of, you know, get back at him somehow. So a whole story is built around it. Not only do we do that individually, but we do it in our cultures. We do it about, you know, the French, the Taliban. You know, we build complex stories about people who make us feel insecure, or people who threaten us, or people who cause us pain and suffering. Do you see what I mean? So our culture is developing whole stories. So all of this is included in samya, in perception. So it's building a rationale for the emotions that we hold. We might, you know, a rationale. He is a bad person. That's why I have the right to feel hatred towards him. Or, you know, she is an angel. You know, she is a perfect being. That's why I've got a perfect right to have, you know, this desire for her. So we have certain emotions, we have certain feelings, quite complex, and we build stories around it. We build rationalizations of those stories in order to kind of stabilize the whole thing. Now, the effect of all this is to produce a consciousness, to produce an understanding, to produce a view of the world that we're seeing. So we start to create a me. This word for consciousness is vijnana. The prefix vi means splitting. So it's a jnana, it's a knowledge that's split into subject and object. So we create this subject-object duality because of our reactions and responses to it. We're going to be looking a lot more at this process in the course, in the talks from next week onwards. So I won't say much more about that now. But the effect of creating this vijnana, creating this split consciousness, is that the split is between me and the world. It creates a world. It creates a sense of something out there. So let's move on now and have a little look at my world. The world, as I think I pointed out last week, is mind-created. I'm going to read the quote that I read from William Boyd last week. Reality is neutral. The world, unperceived by our senses, lay out there like a skeleton impoverished and passionless. When we open our eyes, when we smelled, when we heard, touched and tasted, we added the flesh to these bones according to our natures and how well our imagination functioned. That's what this process is doing. Thus the individual transforms the world. A person's mind weaves its own bright covering over neutral reality. This world created by us is a fiction. It's not non-existent. We're dealing with raw material, which comes in through this form, but we are creating an interpretation of it, which we believe is how it really is. In the Dhammapada, which I didn't quote properly last week, the first two verses are this. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox that's pulling it. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like the shadow that never departs. A rather more subtle image. Here also we see a definition of pure and impure. This is the definition of pure and impure, if you like. A pure mind generates a happy world. An impure world mind creates a painful world. And we'll see later how this degree of impurity is related to how we hold on to the idea of I, me and mine. So Buddhism focuses interest and investigation on the mind, not the world out there. Edward Conser, a great Buddhist translator, said that he thought that this is why China never developed the scientific investigation of the world, because Buddhism was so kind of focused on the mind rather than the external world. He thought that sort of the ingenuity of the Chinese mind would otherwise have looked into the developed scientific materialism, but they didn't because of this this perception. However, Buddhism did develop a very highly sophisticated science of the mind through observing it and observing its interactions. In order to really understand Buddhism, and particularly the things I'm going to be talking about tonight, I think we need a shift of perspective. We need to shift to a mind-centered as opposed to an object-centered basis for our experience. That doesn't mean to say it's selfish, but it's just that it's our mind that that forms the basis of things, rather than the outside world. This is quite an important shift and quite a difficult one, I think, for us brought up in the way we have been. It doesn't ignore the content of that experience, especially it doesn't ignore other beings, other people, who are the content of that experience. So mind-centered does not mean self-centered, but it still means we come back to the mind. So we experience ourselves as living in a particular world, but this experience is generated by our mind, and therefore it can be transformed. We can change quite radically the nature of the world that we experience ourselves as living in by working on the structures, the conditioning processes that go on within our own minds. So let's have a little look at the worlds now. Buddhist tradition analyses the experience of the worlds into a spectrum, and it identifies six different realms in that spectrum, each of which is the interpretation that's laid onto the bare bones of what's actually there. Now these worlds that Buddhism describes are not metaphors. They're not metaphors for psychological states. They refer to the actual nature of experienced reality. This was, I kind of got an insight into this in two different ways, which I'm going to tell you to just lighten things up a little bit. I was staying with a friend of mine in Missoula, Montana, and he had a ferret. It was actually an albino ferret, and it lived indoors, and it was blind, pretty much blind. Now, I was sitting one day in the sitting room with the ferret, and I was just, I don't know what I was doing, I was just sitting there watching the ferret, I suppose, and I saw the ferret sort of going around, you know, with its nose in the air, going here, there and everywhere with its nose in the air. And I suddenly realised that that ferret lived in a world of odours. What a strange world that must be, to live in a world of odours and to be able to identify from, you know, three-dimensionally an odour. So, he could tell where I was. He could tell where his food was and so on. And he could do this all through smells. So he lived in a world completely dominated, or mainly dominated, by odours. And I thought that's miraculous, to think of another world that is based so differently. Bringing it a bit nearer to home, I was once in the East End of London. I lived at the London Buddhist Centre. And I went out for a walk one beautiful spring day into one of the local parks. Gorgeous day, you know, the daffodils were coming up, and it was really, really lovely, blue skies. And I saw three or four drunks sitting on a park bench, who were well gone. This was about 9 o'clock in the morning, and they looked and acted miserably, really, really badly. And I just thought, I'm living in a completely different world to them. My world is a different world to their world. And it just became so obvious that they were different worlds. When you see a very stark contrast like that, you realise how strongly the mind affects them. They lived in a world, you know, which was dominated by sort of confusion and paranoia, whereas I was living in a world which was dominated by sort of, you know, brightness and enjoyment. So again, these little examples just show these are not metaphors, and we can't say that okay, my world's the real world, but that ferret's world is just some aberration, ferrety aberration, or the drunkard's world is just, that's not the real world. No, each of us has got our own real world, and they're very, very different. So, what are these realms? Let's see, I'm just going to go through them and try and conjure them. I mean, actually the Buddha was so good at this, he could take people off into the realms, but probably can't do that. But I think this is a way, this is what a magician can do. A real magician can manipulate the mind into another world. David Brown, is that his name? Darren Brown. Darren Brown. Now, he's a magician, because he can manipulate the minds of people to see things in the way that he wants them to see. There is such a thing as magic, and magic is the ability of the magician to create in the minds of other people whatever he wants them to. So, I can't do that. I'm not a magician. The first realm, which is easiest perhaps to imagine, is the human realm. Now, what is it about the human realm? Well, the human realm is a happy, healthy realm, good family, nice family life, comfortable domestic life. More than that, it's a communal life, it's the tribal life, it's the sort of village life, it's the, you know, interacting with other people. It involves some kind of creative work, some kind of, not, I don't mean artistic, but some sort of skill, some sort of ability to work, contribute to the well-being of the community. Skilled craftsmen are often mentioned in Buddhist texts. The Buddha often takes as his example of a healthy human being, a skilled craftsman, or a skilled craftsman's apprentice. So it's that kind of life, you know, good basic human life, including some kind of spiritual practice, some element of spiritual practice. So an ordinary, regular, good life, That's the human realm. And occasionally we visit it. I'm sure all of us have popped there once or twice in our lives, at least. The next realm is the realm of the Asuras. Now, the Asuras are, this is slightly different from some interpretations, I'm going to risk this. The Asuras are the great heroes. They are inspiring heroes who rise above the norm, often, unfortunately, through the use of violence. So they're the sort of people that have become great emperors, great kings, great warriors, great adventurers, often involved with, you know, power and dominion. But there's something rather magnificent about these people. They are, in the Buddhist sense, they are slightly above the human realm. There's something in them that is that's kind of sort of powerful and admirable. They're sort of between the humans and the gods, which we'll be talking about in a minute. So they're not ordinary human people. They're superhuman in some way, in terms of their what they've achieved and what they've done in their life. Although quite often, as I say, with the use of violence, not something which we would necessarily admire. It's great military heroes, great kings and lords who have great wealth and power. Female Asuras use their sexual wiles. Again, something we might not entirely approve of. But nonetheless, that's what they do. That's how they rise to great heights. Cleopatra, of course, is a kind of perhaps a classic example. And I think Elizabeth I was, you've got to admire the woman. She was absolutely brilliant. She was a cut above a normal human being. But, you know, she used coquetry and sort of playing people off against each other in order to get her way. There is a historical context that is, I think, is quite important in understanding this. Just before the Buddha's life, up to maybe just a few hundred years before, there was a conflict between two cultures. There was the Aryan culture, which had come down from Central Asia, and it was a warrior culture. So it was a culture in which the heroes were admired. They took what they needed through battle. They stole what they needed through battle. But at the same time, there was developing an agrarian community, which was much more what we'd recognise as human. But the agrarian community also developed a conception of a different kind of god, the gods of the Vedas, who were, I'll say a little bit more about in a minute. Now, there were battles, there were real fights between these two cultures over quite a long period of time, striving for dominance. In the Indian caste system, they're represented, of course, by the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, yeah, the warrior castes. So these castes are still represented, at least the image of them is still represented in Indian culture. But for many hundreds of years, this was the historical situation. You've got the agrarian people clearing areas of the forest, growing things, setting up, stable villages and towns, and then the warriors would come down, destroy the whole lot, steal all the goodies and so on. So this was going over a long period of time. In Buddhist mythology, the gods and the Asuras are seen as continually struggling for the wish-fulfilling tree. They both feel that they've got a right to this wish-fulfilling tree, the tree that satisfies all one's desires. So let's have a look at the gods. The word, of course, is Deva. Gods, with a small g, is a good translation, but also perhaps rather more like angels. They're sort of beings that live on a higher level, They are strongly associated with meditation. Now, the thing about meditation is in meditation, consciousness has been withdrawn from the senses. It's been separated from the senses. The gods can be, the god realms can be experienced spontaneously, but they're not much more normally associated with meditation, with withdrawal of senses, with withdrawal of consciousness from sense experience. So you could say that these, the god realms, are the realm of the imagination. They're in the realm of the imagination. They're not so much in the realm of the senses. Just a reminder here, imagined does not mean non-existence. Imagined experience can sometimes be much more real, even much more meaningful, and of much greater value and much more memorable than sense experience. Profound feelings, for example, are no less real because they don't arise through the senses. Intense love, ecstasy, these are feelings that can arise without a sense object. The whole range of powerful positive emotions, which we'll be talking about in future, these can arise. And the gods, in a way, are the objectification of these emotions. The god realm is the realm generated by and expressive of these very strong positive emotions. Now, I think I've got time to, I'm going to give you an example from my own experience. I was, it's at Gigaloka on a long retreat. I was meditating and I was struggling with this image which kept coming into my mind and I couldn't get rid of it. It was an image of a Venetian palace in the 18th century. Beautifully decorated. Lots of golds, blues, very rich reds, wonderful tapestries, beautiful furniture, people dressed in the most exquisite sort of, you know, period costumes. And very beautiful people. Wonderfully beautiful people. Unfortunately, a lot of them didn't have all that much on. And there was a lot going on that I found a bit disturbing in my meditation. And I thought, oh, this is fancy sexual fantasy. Let's put that aside and get back to the meditation. The image came back. Put it aside again. The image came back. This went on for a day or two. But I could not get this Venetian palace party out of my mind. And in the end, I suddenly thought, hang on, the representations of heaven, lower heavens for sure, heavens are often, well, these beautiful people lying around on chaise longues, you know, eating grapes and looking absolutely beautiful and quite often naked. So is this a sexual fantasy or is it a god realm? Now, I came to the conclusion it was a god realm. So I just let myself go into that Venetian palace. And one of the things I noticed was that although there was these things that could have been considered quite erotic, that they weren't sexual, but they were erotic. There was a sense amongst all of the people in this palace that they were all part of something sort of amorphous. And so they could, you know, their nakedness was no problem. It was just sort of all part of a glorious sort of warm engagement with everybody. But there was no sense of any kind of jealousy. There was no sense of sexual desire, actually. There was nothing sort of negative about it. And I thought, no, this is a god realm. Not a particularly high one, but it was a god realm. And the thing that took me into it was that in my when I look back at my own experience, what I was actually experiencing in myself, I was experiencing a kind of very profound contentment and a sense of almost erotic involvement with what was around me, with space, with the universe. So it wasn't sexual, but it took a sexual image. And this made me realise that this is what I think is meant by god realms, that it's a realm that becomes, it's a real experience. You experience it, but it represents, it's the objective counterpart of something very positive that one's actually experiencing oneself. But you can't quite experience it until you've got an object. It's almost like in order to have these very profound experiences, you need an object to reflect off of. Now, this is what I think is the God realm. One of the qualities of such an experience is that you're not quite sure whether this object, this Venetian palace, well, is it my imagination or am I really here? It's never quite clear. There's always some sort of confusion about the subject and object. I think in great art, poetry, sculpture, particularly for the person that produces it, there's a similar sort of experience. There's a loss of subject and object in the creation of that work of art. In music, this is particularly noticeable, even just to a listener, that, you know, if you listen, I'm thinking of Handel's Messiah because it was the first thing that really hit me in this way. You're just not sure whether that music is in you or outside of you. There's something kind of that lifts you above this distinction. So there are many, many levels, different levels of these kind of experiences. But they're all highly pleasurable. They can be ecstatic, they're blissful, and they're profoundly satisfying. They're higher, subtle realms. Sometimes they have a kind of very material quality. Again, once I was in the mountains in Mont Blanc, and just being surrounded by these incredible peaks covered in snow. I mean, it was just, I felt I was surrounded by gods. I'd moved into a god realm. But it was a material form that generated that response. It can be just purely imaginative. But it can be very real, as in the same way that dreams can be very real when you're involved with them. You don't think of them as being just imagination. They're real. But in these cases, it's the manifestation of a higher, more profound mental state. I've talked about visual examples because I think I'm a kind of visual person, but it can be sound as well, music. It can also be perfume. Sometimes people smell the perfume of the gods and don't actually see them, but they just get a whiff of something unbelievably beautiful. It can also be somatic. You can actually kind of feel it. You can feel your body doing strange things, either expanding, getting very, very, very large, or getting very, very, very small, or twisting in ways that are totally impossible, but you can actually feel your body moving in those ways. So it can take all of these different forms. Form, in this sense, form of some sort of subtle sense input. It can also be into a formless realm. And traditionally, the description is as follows. In these formless God realms, the distinction between subject and object is even more attenuated than usual. It's the realm of infinite space, and experiences oneself as being in infinity, of infinite consciousness, of neither perception nor non-perception, and no thingness. I mean, these are getting pretty subtle. These are still objects, but they're pretty subtle objects. One thing we should remember is that the realm of the gods, like all the other realms, are impermanent. Gods appear in them, and then they die. They disappear. They move on to another realm. So we must always be thinking of ourselves as transmigrating through all of these different realms. The other three I'm going to deal with rather more briefly. There's the animal realm, which is just like, you know, the animals that we see around us, the ferret and so on. Self-consciousness is at work, but it's pre-language and it's not very highly developed. So it's a not particularly well-developed self-consciousness. The hungry ghosts, this is a realm in which the beings are completely obsessed by some form of craving for something or other. So their whole world is dominated by this sense of craving. And then, of course, there's the hell realms. There are many of them. The Tibetans, I think, have about 30 or 40 different hell realms. These are realms of intense, continuous and unremitting suffering. There are different sorts. There's hot realms and there's cold realms. The cold realms are the deepest. The deepest, the most painful of all the realms are the cold realms. And in those realms, you're absolutely rigid. You can't do anything. You're frozen, frozen solid. And it seems like you're frozen solid for all eternity. Although it's not all eternity. The hot realms are realms of passion, where one is sort of consumed by intense passion, either craving or hatred. In the realms, one is continually tortured by others. It's others that cause this pain. They're the ones that make, stab you and poke you and light the fires and, you know, do all the other nasty things that happen to you in those hells. But the hells also are impermanent. They're just part of the whole realm of transmigration. So what is it that moves us around through these, what is it that drives the transmigration through the different realms? I'm going to be talking more about this in future, but the primary thing is the intensity of identification with a self. The more strongly one has a sense of me, then the more painful, the lower is the realm into which one is born. So this sense of me and I am, which is, as it were, it's the primary force that creates me, and it's also the primary force that generates the realm in which we exist. Because there's a whole variety of emotions, there's a whole richness of emotions, there's a whole richness of worlds as well. But we can see this sense of I am as the primary cause. In the hells, it's most intense. You're in hell, in a way, because you're completely obsessed with yourself. The hungry ghosts are obsessed with an object, but really they're just obsessed with themselves. So that also is a realm of suffering. The animals, although they have a weak sense of self, they can't do anything about it. They haven't got sufficient awareness in order to move on to something else. So that is also a realm of suffering. The Asuras, the humans and the gods have got, the gods have got, as you go up to higher heaven realms, as it were, there's less and less of self there. So when you'll get to the level of experiencing the infinity of space, there's very little self left. It's been sort of absorbed entirely. The subject-object distinction has been absorbed entirely. So we could say that the realm that we enter is that the intensity with which we hold on to the self determines the realm in which we will be reborn. So attenuation of the sense of self is the key to a happy rebirth as either an asura, a human, or a god. But it's also the key to liberation into transcendental consciousness, which is incredibly fortunate. Because what you can do is you can work towards liberation, and at the same time, you're working towards creating a happy world in which to live. So from all this, we see the importance of the mind in the Buddhist view of who we are and where we are going. So in the next few talks, we'll be looking into the mind in more detail to try and uncover its workings so that we can create a happier world for ourselves and help others to do the same. And also, in investigating the nature of the mind, looking into the depths of our own self-consciousness, we will discover there's something else, there's something even more miraculous. In the depths of that mind, there is a new level of consciousness, a new mind, a new order of conditionality, a new level of evolution, which is the transcendental mind, the enlightened mind. And that's what we'll be moving on to later on in the talks. Okay. Sorry, that was a bit longer than I hoped for. But we'll if we could now have perhaps a silent leg stretch, a silent break, and then so as to kind of keep the concentration and take that into the meditation. So there'll be about half an hour of meditation in about five minutes time.